Every one of us have things that we consider important, things that are valuable, things that we give ourselves to. Some of those things that we feel are important and we give ourselves to, we even sacrifice other things because of just how relevant and important those different things that we hold dear are to each of us. Some of us sacrifice our time because our job is very important. We want to do a good job. And we neglect other things because we're so focused on our occupation. For others, it might be their family and the amount of time that they would spend in their family and with their family to try to accomplish the things that are beneficial. Every one of us has some form of pleasure that we want to add to our life and to our daily experience. We want to find that satisfaction and joy that only the things that we find to be pleasurable can provide. And so the real question would be for each one of us, what are we living for? What's really important to us? What is it that directs and guides our life? What I find is that while every one of us have values or goals or objectives or things we live for, most individuals are very disappointed, unfulfilled, not finding that those things provide them with a benefit that they expected. Not far, in fact, in the same building from where we have our physical therapy practice, there's a counseling service. I'm amazed at the number of people that come in that counseling clinic every day. No shortage of clients for those individuals. And what also amazes me is young children are coming because they don't know how to cope with things. Teenagers are coming. Young adults. Older adults. How do you put life together? Where do we find value? People go through crisis in life because they find the things they were living for are not as fulfilling as they thought they would be. Or they're frustrated because what they wanted to accomplish, they're not able to accomplish. And therefore, they find life is a disappointment. A book was written not too long ago. The title was Life is Good. Is it? Well, maybe for some individuals. But if I look at what's happening in the Middle East, if I look at what's happening in Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Syria, if I look at what's happening in the Baltic states, if I think of what's taking place in parts of Africa, if I look at what's even happening in Central and South America, I don't know if those individuals would say life is good. And we find that one of the big problems we have in America is an immigration problem. Because somehow people have grown to think that America is the utopia to provide people with the fulfillment of their dreams, purpose in life, and satisfaction. So the question I ask you again is, what are you living for? To think about the answer to that question, I'd like you to turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's a book that many individuals haven't spent the time studying or reading, and part of it, I think, is because the evil one has caused us to misunderstand the real message of this book. Without a doubt, I have been convinced for a number of years that if there ever was a book that is relevant for our American culture, and in particular in the last few decades, that book is the book of Ecclesiastes. If there was ever a book to cause individuals to really consider, what is life all about? Where is it that I find meaning and purpose and relevance? Where is it I find satisfaction and fulfillment? The book of Ecclesiastes gives us that answer. Because in the book of Ecclesiastes, we find that the author deals with all the things that individuals live for. And what the author of Ecclesiastes found concerning all that individuals live for, as it says in verse 2, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher. "All is vanity. Vanity of vanities." And we'll talk a little bit about this idea of vanity. But first we need to set a stage and better understand what's going on in this book. And because it has been so misunderstood, even in conservative Bible-believing circles, we need to take the time to get a correct orientation to what's here. What I found to be sad is many individuals, as Bible teachers who I highly respect, really present an erroneous view about the book of Ecclesiastes. Some individuals would say, "I wonder if this book ought to be even included in the Bible. It certainly isn't looking at life the way we would understand it in the New Testament." I would greatly disagree. There are other individuals that have said, "Well, we're looking at a book that was written that really isn't truth. It's man wrestling as man with the things in life and finding that there's futility and vanity associated with it." If you turn with me to chapter 12, you will notice that this same one who said, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity," in chapter 1, says in verse 10, "The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write the words of" what? Truth. How? Correctly. So for some Bible teacher to say, this is man in his unregenerate state, without divine revelation, looking at life and isn't relevant for God's people and how they're to live, doesn't understand the book of Ecclesiastes. Because what this individual says he sought to do is to write the words of truth accurately. Words of truth. Not just a true statement, because we can have a true statement about what the devil does, what the devil says, can't we? But for the devil to say, "You will not die," that's a lie, but it's a true statement that was made by the devil. But that's not truth. Truth is the absolute, the foundation upon which all else emanates. And the author of this book said he sought to write the words of truth accurately, correctly. So what do we know about this book? Well, the title of the book, Ecclesiastes, actually comes from the Septuagint, or the Greek translation of the Old Testament. It is related to a word that we're more familiar with in the New Testament, and that word is the ekklesia. What is the ekklesia? Why, that's the assembly or the church. And the word Ecclesiastes, derived from ekklesia, is a person that speaks to or addresses the ekklesia or the assembly. The Hebrew title for this book is Koheleth. Now, it's very similar in meaning, but sadly, when we see the word preacher, what do we automatically think of? We think of a church setting. we think of someone providing us with religious instruction. And that's not the basic meaning of this term. The one who is speaking, who is giving us this information, is the lecturer, is the teacher, is the speaker before an assembly. He has convened an assembly of people. They have been called out to a public gathering, and to that public gathering, this individual is making his presentation. So where we read, "Vanity of vanity," says the preacher. Let's think of it as the teacher, the one who has convened the assembly, like a speaker of the house or a speaker of a group, and he's conveying information to them. The second would be, well, who is this individual? And so we find that the speaker, the teacher, the individual who is providing us with this instruction does not provide us with his personal name. But he says a number of things within this lecture, this teaching, this presentation, this persuasive speech, if we put it into the arena of going to school and taking different classes, knowing how to present a subject in a way that moves the hearers to respond in the way in which the individual wants them to respond. This speaker identifies himself with statements that he makes about himself. If we look at these statements that are made by this individual, what we find is this individual indicates that, first, it says he is the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So in verse 1, he identifies himself by telling us he is an individual that is in the line of the family of David, and he served as king in the headquarters, the capital city for Israel, that is Jerusalem. The second thing he says about himself, verse 12, "I, the preacher," the one proclaiming, teaching this truth, "have been king over Israel," where? In Jerusalem. Now that becomes instructive to me, because if you remember when we look at the unfolding of biblical history for the nation of Israel, basically once they were constituted as a nation, brought out of Egypt, and put in a relationship with one another through their constitution, which we know of as the Mosaic Covenant, and they were brought into the land in which that nation was to conduct itself, there is a period where the whole nation, all 12 tribes, are together. And then there is a division that takes place in the nation of Israel. And the northern kingdom, consisting of 10 tribes, is known of as Israel. And the southern kingdom, with 2 tribes, is known of as the kingdom of Judah. And this author says that he was king over Israel, in Jerusalem. Another indication that this individual would be one who was living during the time of all 12 tribes together. Then if you notice with me, over in verse 16. Of chapter 1. This author says, "Behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me." In other words, there's no one wiser than me of the family of David that has been a ruler in Jerusalem over Israel. Now, if we think about the line of David, we can see that there were some godly kings that wisely ruled over the kingdom of Judah. But none of those kings were as wise as one of David's sons. Who was that?
Solomon.
And extra-biblically, Jewish tradition has always affirmed that the book of Ecclesiastes was written by none other than Solomon himself. He also speaks about verse 9 of chapter 2. I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Now, what's he talking about? His greatness and how he increased more than every other king in Jerusalem. He's talking about his building projects. He's talking about his financial prosperity. He is talking about the wealth that he accumulated and trickled down to all of the nation. And everyone will acknowledge, if we look at the history of Israel, the golden age, the time of the greatest prosperity in Israel was during the days of Solomon. No other king came close to providing for the well-being and the benefit of the Israelites than Solomon. And then the last thing that we'll just add for now, verse 9 of chapter 12. In verse 9 of chapter 12, in addition to being a wise man, the Koheleth, the teacher, the preacher, also taught the people knowledge. And he pondered and he searched out and arranged many what? Proverbs. And when we look at the accolades of Solomon, we find that he was an individual that provided the people with great wisdom and pithy little sayings to help them remember it in what you and I think of as Proverbs. And we have a book that is a record of many of the Proverbs that were written by Solomon, but certainly not all of them. If I remember right, there's over 3,000 Proverbs we learned that were written by Solomon, and we just have a few of them in the book of Proverbs. Now, the idea of discrediting Solomon as the author is something of a more recent fashion, when individuals coming out of a mindset of German higher criticism have tried to destroy the integrity of the scripture. Now, I'm not wanting to just become so academic and belabor these points, but if you want to search out of what I'm telling you, which I encourage you to do, you are going to read in many commentaries that are conducted by good Bible teachers that they begin to question the authorship of Solomon. And where, in my thinking, in the book of Solomon itself, we find that much information is given about him. Now, what is the type of book that we have? Well, this book would be classified as a book that deals with chokmah, or wisdom. While all of the Bible is wisdom, the book of Ecclesiastes is in the classification of a wisdom book. In other words, it wants to deal with some of life's most perplexing questions and provide us with God's answer. We can look at some of the other books that we think of as wisdom books. And for example, the book of Psalms is the expression of one's relationship with God in the way of worship. And that's most fundamental to every individual's life. And so the book of Psalms, while it is the hymn book for the nation of Israel, is a wisdom book also to give us an orientation and a direction of how we express our relationship with God, either by way of petition for our need or praise for His provision. Well, when I look at the book of Ecclesiastes, there's even a more fundamental question, and it's the one that we could express in a variety of different ways, but the book written by Solomon is asking that fundamental question: what are you living for? What do you think really matters? How is it you put life together? What gives you meaning and purpose and fulfillment in life? In a very real sense, this book is written by an individual who is presenting himself as a teacher over his students. And in particular, if you look, since we last were in chapter 12, but one occasion, if you look in chapter 12, verse 12, the author says, "But beyond this, my son, be warned that the writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is a wearying of the body." The term I'm looking for is "my son." And the idea is the fact that when an individual sat under the instruction of another, it was like a parent-child type relationship. Now, it doesn't mean that the book of Ecclesiastes isn't relevant for a father actually instructing his children. But more importantly, it is the teacher who has the students assembled and they are receiving instruction from that individual as a son. It's not any different than what we're called upon in our relationship with God and the church. What's the Great Commission? Go into all the world and make what? Disciples. And the Greek word for disciple is go into all the world and make students, to make learners, to make individuals who sit at the feet of Christ, and as the children of God are learning from the master teacher the things that are relevant for their life. And so we have it in the book of Ecclesiastes. And in a very real sense then, this individual is speaking as a philosopher. And as Christians, we need to appreciate that we have the privilege of being philosophers. A philosopher is none other than phileo, love, affection, delight, sophia, wisdom. A philosopher is a lover of wisdom. And this philosopher is saying, where do you find relevance for your life? Where do you find meaning and purpose in your life? How do you put life together so that there's a satisfaction that you find in life? And to some individuals, they will say that the book of Ecclesiastes is a very depressing book. And it's a depressing book if you are living for one of the things that Solomon says is vanity. And if the foundation and the focus of your life is not the theme that the author of this book brings out. So with that in mind, if it is looking at how we find meaning in life, what is it that we need to understand? Well, to clarify and look at the concentration of this book, there are a number of things that we need to bring up. The first is, I want to just quote some individuals, and I'm not even going to mention their name, that to minimize or depreciate the value of this book as truth. It begins by saying Ecclesiastes is a book of man under the sun, reasoning about life, and the philosophy it sets forth, which makes no claim to revelation, but which inspiration requires for our instruction. I'm appalled that this individual would say it makes no claim to revelation. What did the preacher say in chapter 12? That he sought delightful words and to write the words of truth, that's revelation, accurately. And what this individual was saying is that this is coming from a non-enlightened viewpoint and takes that phrase under the sun as expressing the way an individual lives in this life without a relationship with God. When I looked up this term, under the sun, or this phrase, I found that it's used in the book of Ecclesiastes over 30 times. I got tired of counting. Over 30 times this phrase, under the sun. And what I found is that when you really search out each of the times it's used, It doesn't mean man living apart from God. What it does mean is where you and I exist in this world. Where do the inhabitants of this world live? Under the sun. And that's why many of you wear sunscreen. Because there's nowhere that you can live in this world that you're not under the sun. And let me just give you an example of this phrase, under the sun, that may help you see the idea that it's broader than just saying, this is the person living in a non-Christian way, or the individual that has no relationship with God. For example, in chapter 5, verse 18, notice what the author Solomon says. Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting, to eat and to drink and enjoy oneself and all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life, which God has given him. This is his reward. So he's not talking about people living under the sun that is excluding any relevance with God. He says living this way is a reward that comes from God. And we'll talk more about that later. Or over in chapter 9. And in verse 9. The writer says, enjoy life with a woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he, that is God, has given you where? Under the sun. That can't be a biblical concept, that a Christian man should enjoy life with the spouse that God's given him. I said that in quotes for the benefit of those that may hear it later on. It's very biblical. It's very New Testament. In fact, what are we commanded to do? Husbands, love your wives. Why? Because that's God's design. And here we find this individual is to love the woman all the days of your fleeting life, which God gives you where? Under the sun. For this is your reward in life and in your toil, which you have labored where? Under the sun. In other words, this is man's condition. I exist in this physical world under the sun. And the question is, do I have a relationship with God as I live under the sun? Or do I not have a relationship with God as I live under the sun? And I should have an outlook on life that is vastly different from the person that has no relationship. But even though my perspective on life is different, I still live under the sun. It's our place of existence. Another Christian teacher said, keep in mind the conclusions in this experiment are human, not God's truth. If I go back to chapter 12, the conclusions, for example, verse 1, what should I do? The young people that are with us, remember your Creator. That's a human conclusion. It's not truth. When should I remember my Creator? In the days of my youth. And where did this idea come from? Notice what he says in verse 11, chapter 12. The words of a wise man are like goads, and the masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. And they are given how? By one shepherd. Who is the shepherd that gave this to us? None other than God himself. Another says, as he begins his commentary on Ecclesiastes, it's one of the most puzzling books in the Bible. It has the problem of expressing apparent, unorthodox statements and is an expression of pessimism. Doesn't express pessimism. Doesn't express unorthodox statements. It analyzes what people are living for. And the pessimism is found in the fact that if you're living for one of the typical pursuits that people endeavor to find fulfillment and happiness in life, you're going to be disappointed. Because vanity of vanity, says the teacher, all is vanity. Now, how about this term vanity? What's meant by it? Well, it is the Hebrew word habel. Habel is the word for breath or for wind. And it metaphorically begins to take on the idea of something that is empty. Something that has no substance to it. Something that is unfulfilling. And so we speak of it as vanity or futility. It has no real value. Now, what kind of things is he going to look at that he says is empty and having no value? Materialism. Living for all the things of this world. Finding my hope and my sense of well-being in the temporal rather than the eternal. He's going to tell us that what's really most important is having a God-centered life. And if your objective in life is anything less than that, you're going to come up empty. You're going to be disappointed. You're going to find unsatisfied existence. Notice just a couple of places where he brings out his theme. If you look back in chapter 8, verse 12, although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his days, I know that it will be well for those who what? What does it say? Fear God. And besides saying for those who fear God, he says, don't keep it to yourself. What kind of God-fearing life? Who fear him openly. Something demonstrated in life that sets the individual apart from the people that might be religious, might be moral, might be ethical, but are living for the temporal in contrast to those who are living for the eternal. And certainly in chapter 12 and in verses 13 and 14, he says, the conclusion when all has been heard is to do what? Fear God. Keep his commandments. Who is this got bearing on? It applies to every man. The reality is, whether you want to acknowledge God in your life and have him as the center of your worldview, it doesn't matter. Truth applies to every man. And it's only the God-fearing individual, and we'll talk more about the relevance of that term of being a God-fearing individual, that finds meaning and satisfaction and purpose in life. And that's the message of Ecclesiastes. Now, how does he develop that message? Well, when I look at the components of this book, he breaks it down very simply. He's going to first say, this is what I want to tell you. Here's my premise. Then he's going to develop his premise. Then he's going to make deductions from his premise. And then he's going to wrap it all up and say, this is what I've been telling you. He's got an introduction. He's got the body of his message. And he's got his conclusion. And in chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, we have the prologue. He has the statement of his premise. All pursuits in this world are utter vanity of themselves. They won't provide fulfillment and satisfaction. In chapters 1, verse 12, through the end of chapter 6, verse 12, he develops that theme and shows how earthly pursuits leave individuals empty and unsatisfied. And since that is the truth, since that's how it is, in chapter 7, verse 1 through 12, verse 7, here's the deductions. And the deduction is this. Fearing God gives relevance to the individual, meaning and purpose, and fulfillment in life. So this is what I've been telling you, he says in my conclusion, chapter 12, verses 8 through 14. The most important issue for us all is, do I have that relationship with God? Do I fear Him? Now, as we look at the book of Ecclesiastes, what we need to understand is the people of this world are in a state of great confusion. A number of years ago, in fact, it was published in 1976, a man by the name of Francis Schaeffer wrote a work called How Should We Then Live? The subtitle, The Rise and the Decline of Western Thought and Culture. And as he looked at it, he said, what we have found happening in our culture is that meaning and purpose in life have become increasingly eschewed in our society, and therefore values died. And the majority of people adopted the two impoverished values of personal peace and affluence. In other words, the American dream. And that's what most people live for. He defines the idea of personal peace as wanting to be left alone, not be troubled by the troubles of other people, whether across the world or across the city, to live one's life with minimal possibilities of being personally disturbed. Personal peace means wanting to have my personal life pattern undisturbed during my lifetime, regardless of what results there may be, either to my children or my grandchildren. By affluence, Francis Schaeffer says, I mean an overwhelming and ever-increasing prosperity, a life made up of things, things, and more things. A success judged by an ever higher level of material abundance. Now, he was writing this in the 70s. And he had analyzed that revolution that took place in the 60s. And the 60s was a tumultuous time in our culture because the young people were saying the values of the previous generations are wrong. We want to jettison that. We're not going to live for just personal peace and affluence. And the hippie movement came out of it. And you know what happened? The hippies became the yuppies. And the baby boomer generation adopted the same values of personal peace and affluence. I want to get everything I can out of this world. And so today we have a new uprising of young people that say, you know, I look at the older generations and I find hypocrisy. Individuals who say value is found in prosperity and things. Everything's motivated by trying to get more in this life. And no one wants to commend what either group did. But what's so sad is the cycle keeps repeating. We want to jettison it. And yet we still go back to the same temporal orientation that what I'm really living for is my own comfort, having things in this world, wanting to get ahead. Why do we go to college? Why do we encourage our kids to go to college? I want you to have it easier than I had it, son. I want you to be able to make a good living. I don't want you to have to work as hard as I had to work. We've all heard, maybe even stated, those same things. because the impoverished values of our culture are personal peace and affluence. And individuals are either very idealistic and optimistic, thinking, boy, we're going to find fulfillment in the things, or they become very disillusioned and pessimistic and find that the things of this world never satisfy. So what we find in our culture, in our time, is the fact that, like Ecclesiastes would say, life is meaningless apart from God. And you're not going to find purpose and meaning in nature, in money, in self-indulgence, in property and possessions and position, in your intellect and your wisdom and your learning, in your philosophies and your religions, in your free expression, your sexual promiscuity. It's all going to diminish the value of you as a person and leave you unfulfilled. The world does not contain the key to itself. You can't unlock the mysteries of life in what you find in the temporal. It can only be found in God. And so what we see is the conclusion, when everything has been heard, is this. Make God the center. Because the reality is, every one of us here is living for one of two things. And it's exactly what Jesus said in his own day. You cannot serve two masters. You've either made your priority for the toys that you can get in this world and live for mammon, and think that you're going to be happy and find fulfillment in what you can have here, or you are going to serve and live for God. And what we need to understand is that living one's life for God is not a distasteful, wasted life. And even in the Christian community that should know better, there have been times when individuals have looked at people who have given their lives to go to some of the most horrific places in the world and think, what a waste of their life. Because in our value system, we believe having all that this world can offer is really success. When instead, like Jim Elliot stated, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep in order to gain what he cannot lose. So again, I ask, what are you living for? And to answer that question doesn't mean all of a sudden you give up all your goods to feed the poor, or you make personal sacrifices with your life. God is the one that will direct those things. But the real important issue is whether or not you can say with Paul, for to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. And if you're living for anything else, then I say with Solomon, what an empty, futile existence. Because nothing in this world can provide meaning and fulfillment and satisfaction and purpose in life. Only those who focus on their relationship with the Lord come out both with the hope of eternal life and blessing, and fulfillment as they go through this life. And to them, then, life is good, because the holder of life is the highest good, God Himself. Let's pray.